You're all here this morning. If you're visiting, my name's Kent. I'm the preacher here on most Sundays. But we're starting our March for Missions campaign today. And what March for Missions is the next three Sundays, we're going to have speakers come in and talk to you about God's Word, about God's heart for missions, about God's heart for this church to be partnering with Him in missions. Here in about 4 weeks, we're going to have what we call Celebration Sunday.
Can I say a prayer over you?
Yeah, very over me. And this is Zane. Everyone say, hi, Zane. Hi. Everyone say, bye, Zane. God bless Zane is right. So Zane and I have known each other since, in 4 weeks we'll have our Celebration Sunday. We'll have a special collection. Our missions committee this year has a number of projects. You see them in your weekly newsletter. It's stapled on there. You've got them in your email if you check the email. So it describes you all the missionaries we're supporting around the world and a newsletter from our missions committee. It lets you know who they are and what they're up to. But in 4 weeks, our goal is to raise in cash and pledges $100,000 to support missions all over the world and in Oklahoma City. So that's where we're headed. Zane's going to kick us off this week. Zane and I have been friends since back in our years at Oklahoma Christian University. And then we both kind of said, I think we're done with school. Were you done with school? We both said, we're done with school. And so we decided to do two more years at Lubbock Christian. And then I said, I'm never going back to school. And anyways, we kept going back to school. Zane went longer than I did. I finished at Abilene. Zane went to Emory University, got his master's and his doctorate there in New Testament studies, and has spent a lot of his life trying to figure out what Paul's saying and what it means for us today. But today he's going to be talking to us from the Gospels about who Jesus is and what it means to a world that needs to know Jesus. So Zane, let me pray for you real quick, and we'll let you get started. God, I want to ask that you would be with Zane today, that you would bless him with your words that we need to hear. Give him the words and us the ears to hear your word today. It's in your son's name we pray. Amen. Amen. Thanks, Zane.
All right, thank you all. I'm sorry it felt so awkward to be that high above Kent that I didn't know what to do. So thank you all for having me today. I'm really grateful if you were here for a Bible class that we got to spend some time. I would say spend some time getting to know each other, but really I just talked about myself for an hour. So you all got to spend some time getting to know me, but I feel like that in a way that helped connect us and bond us a little bit. I'm grateful to be here talking about missions. I want to commend you as a church first for the intentionality and dedication that you all have towards missions in general, but also, I mean, for a congregation of this size and to see the flags here that are colored by the children's ministry or by Kent, I can't tell which one. That's going to be my running theme, is to just take digs at Kent the whole sermon. The dedication that y'all have to missions and also the dedication to commit to it in this way and do special contributions for it. So I thank y'all for that. And I thank you for inviting me to be here and share with you as well. So I want to start by talking a little bit about, you know, there's moments in life when things kind of come full circle for you and you're back where you started. Being here in the building at Northwest is kind of like that for me, because it's a full circle moment in that the last time that I can remember being in the building here at Northwest, I was also on a mission when I was here. It was a little bit of a different mission and felt nearly impossible at the time, but I'll tell you a quick story that I was grew up, or I went to college at Oklahoma Christian. That's where Kent and I met, and we were in a social club there together, social service club, but there was a lot more emphasis on the social than the service part. And so we were planning our banquet for the fall, for the big banquets that all of the clubs put on, and we as a group of college men in particular were very college age and very poor. So in thinking through how we could put on a banquet, we decided that probably our banquet didn't need to be as fancy as everybody else's. We could probably find a space and we could cook some fancy food ourselves. We were under the direction of our fearless president at that time, Kenton Reeves Brown, who told us, you know, I think I have a location we can use. The church has a fellowship area. I bet we could use that to host our event. And we thought, that's perfect. And then we thought, you know, what's the fanciest food that a college student can imagine? It's clearly lasagna. And so we thought, we're going to cook We as the college, as the men of the social club, for our banquet where we're bringing our significant others at the time, we're going to cook lasagna for them. And we were smart. We didn't try to make it ourselves. We just bought frozen lasagnas. But I think the prior to that night, probably most of us who had ever cooked frozen lasagnas, it was a microwavable, one-serving kind of lasagna. So we show up to the fellowship hall an hour before the banquet's supposed to start. Yeah. We start unloading all of the food that we have, and we had purchased, it was probably about 90 people that we were serving, so we had purchased not just family-sized frozen lasagnas, but like cafeteria-sized frozen lasagnas. And we start reading for the very first time, about 45 minutes before the banquet, we start reading the directions on this. And it says, cook for an hour to 45 minutes to 2 hours and 15 minutes. And we all start, like, clearly that's a typo, right? Like, you can't cook any food for that long. But we ended up cranking the ovens up to 450. Putting those in, and about every 15 minutes, we would go in and carve off an edge that had thawed enough, and we served our dinner in courses, is what we told everybody. So that was our mission at the time when we were here. I'm not a very good preacher, because a good preacher would relate their opening story to their sermon, and that has no connection at all to what we're going to talk about. But I just wanted to share the story. I told Kent that I wanted to share a funny story from our past, but I had to choose, you know, the thin line between what's a funny story and what could get him fired. So that's where we ended up with the lasagna story. So we can talk after if you would like more stories. Something that I was thinking about is how many of you who have been in the church for a while, how many sermons on missions have you probably heard? So I know people in my field, so I was a former missionary. I now work at the Halbert Center for Missions and Global Service at Abilene Christian. I teach courses on missions. I know people in my field would probably say that not enough. No matter how many sermons you've heard on missions, it's not enough. I think other of you would probably say I've heard too many. If we do quick math, you're going to hear 4 sermons this month on missions. So if you've been in the church for 10 years, 15 years, then you've heard 40 to 50 sermons on missions. And I want you to think about what's the key texts that you hear preached on missions Sundays, and what's the key ideas that you hear that come out of mission Sundays. An exercise that I like to do with my missions classes is I ask students on the very first day of class, I ask them to tell me what is missions, and the responses that I get are almost always that the first thing that always comes up, missions is living overseas, so that's the first thing. The second thing generally has to do with learning another language. And then the third thing would have to be serving people. Those are, when we ask students what missions are, those are the responses we get. When I ask students why we do missions, the number one reason, why don't y'all, somebody call out why you think the number one reason students say we do missions is? Sorry? Yeah, to save people, all right? Where do we get the idea that we need to save people? From the Great Commission, right? So the number one response I get from students when I ask why do we do missions is because Jesus told us to. And that's kind of the end of the logic of it. Matthew 28:18, Jesus tells us to go out into the nation and make disciples, so we do it.
Like education? To educate?
Yeah, to educate, to make disciples, to teach them. And we're doing that because Jesus told us. But is there more to the story, right? Is there a reason why Jesus told us to actually think about those things? So I continue to prod them. I continue to think. And the second reason that they come up with is to save people. So we do missions because Jesus told us to. We do missions to save people. But almost never in that conversation that we have does anything come up about the character of God, about what it is that God as a being is desiring for humanity and why it is that maybe Jesus called us to missions to begin with. Does Jesus himself have a reason for sending us on mission? And so I want us to think a little bit about that today as we think about what is God's mission for the world. So we often think that mission starts in Matthew 28:18, which is a little ironic because those are the closing verses of the book of Matthew. And so we would think that Jesus' ministry, his evangelism, his mission to the world begins at the end of his life story. right? But we actually know that if we trace it back through Matthew, that the mission that Jesus is on, the evangelism that he has been doing to people, if we want to use that term, has started throughout the book. In fact, it's began at his birth among us, God living among us at the beginning of that book. But you can go back further. Then you can go back further that actually the mission of God starts at Eden. And it starts with the creation of humanity. And so when we think about what missions means, I want us to think of a broader scope of what it means for us to be thinking of Jesus' ministry and Jesus' missions and how we're called to be a part of it. So we're going to base our time together today in Matthew chapter 10. But before we get to that verse, I want us to take a quick detour and just talk about the context that gets us up to Matthew chapter 10, because that's important. So in Matthew chapter 8 and 9, we have Jesus going through Galilee, doing miracles, doing signs, doing wonders, healing. We have in the Gospel of Matthew, we have nine kind of vignettes, little pictures, little movies that play of Jesus healing nine different people and how those things unfold. And then at the end of those nine stories, we get this summary statement from Matthew. This is in Matthew chapter 9, verse 35. Then Jesus went through all of the towns and the villages, teaching in the synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. That sounds pretty good so far, right? Then we get to 36. That when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them, because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into the harvest field." So what comes immediately after these verses is that Jesus tells his disciples to pray that God would send workers out into the field. And then what do they do? Does he sit and wait for those workers to show up? No, in chapter 10, we immediately go into Jesus then commissions those same disciples who he told to pray about sending people out into the world. Jesus then commissions them to go out and to do that work that he's just finished discussing. We talk about Matthew 28, 18 through 20. That's three verses long, and we refer to it as the Great Commission. Matthew chapter 10, Jesus speaks for about 38 verses commissioning people to do missions. So maybe there's something in these chapters as well that we can learn about missions and what we can expect from it. Now, I would love to tell you that it's all positive, that Jesus has a great vision for how successful the mission of the church will be and how successful missionaries who go out on that mission will be. In our culture, it's very common for us in advertising and media, on TV, for us to see a 60-second commercial and 55 seconds of that commercial be dedicated to the positive things that you're guaranteed to love about this product, and the last 5 seconds of it to be crammed with disclaimers, right? When I was young, it was Hot Wheels cars and micro machines that always had this crazy fast voice at the end of them. As I've gotten older, it's turned to be medicine that has all the disclaimers. I don't know if that's a change in culture or a change in my age, but that's how our culture works. We sell you on all the positives, and then at the very end, we're going to give you the few disclaimers, and we hope that by that point, you've lost enough attention that you're not going to see the downsides that come with it. What Jesus does in chapter 10 is that he starts out telling the disciples that he's sending out, first, go out and don't take any money with you. Because you're going to go out and you're going to find faithful people and you're going to rely on them to support you and give you what you need. Well, that sounds positive. That sounds helpful, right? God promising that you'll be taken care of. But Jesus says, oh, and by the way, not everybody's going to actually help you. In fact, not only are some people not going to help you, there will be entire villages of people that won't help you, and you'll be forced to leave them because they don't support you in your mission and what you're doing. That doesn't sound very positive. But he tells them, don't worry about that, because while you're leaving those villages, you also need to be looking out for wolves. Excuse me? As he said, well, Jesus says, I am sending you out as sheep among wolves. So be on your guard. So he tells them, not only are you not going to have people that support you, and you're not going to have the money that you need to do the things you need to do, you're going to have people who are actively fighting against you. And then he says, on top of that, you should also know that most people are going to hate you for what you're doing. And when he says most people, he doesn't mean the villages that you come across. He says, don't think that I've come to bring peace, but that I have come to turn father against son, mother against daughter, brother against sister. He says, the people that you value closest to you in your life will turn against you if you commit to what I'm doing. And then his last part is he says, that's okay. Don't worry about all of those negative things, and don't worry about the people who can kill your body, because at least they can't kill your soul, right? That's the upside of it. All of those things are going on, but hey, at least they can't take your soul from you. So Jesus spends, all of this doesn't come in a five-second disclaimer at the beginning of the speech. I said the speech is 38 verses long. This is about 34 verses of those 38. Is Jesus begins by saying, people will hate you, you won't have the resources to do the things you're going to do, people will oppose you, and you'll probably lose your very life. Now go out and make disciples. That's a little bit different of a verse than Matthew 28, right? So Jesus gives these warnings. And then he gets out of all of those verses, he comes to the end of this in Matthew chapter 10, verse 40, and he reads the verse that we just read before the sermon. Anyone who receives you receives me, and anyone who receives me receives the Father who sent me. If you receive a prophet as one who speaks for God, you will be given the same reward as a prophet. And if you receive a righteous person because of their righteousness, you will be given a reward like theirs. And if you give even a cup of cold water to one of the least of my followers, you will surely be rewarded. Now these verses, I've talked about Matthew 28 a lot today. Matthew 28, we're very familiar with the Great Commission. These verses, I think, are probably on par with our familiarity of these verses, that we've heard them so many times they make sense to us, or we think they make sense to us. But I think it's important for us to pause and think about the things in this passage that actually don't make sense, right? So let's look at a couple things. First, who is Jesus talking to in these final verses? Because the commission all throughout this has been to the disciples who are the ones who are going out. And then in verse 40 through 42, Jesus shifts to not talking about the disciples and how they will be received by people, but he actually shifts to talking about how people are to receive those who are doing the work. So when we get to these final verses, I think it's important for us to recognize that maybe Jesus isn't so much speaking to the disciples who are going out at this point as he is speaking to us today about how we're supposed to be receiving and supporting the work that he's doing. The second thing that's strange about this is that we've got some really weird accounting going on in these verses. Are there any accountants in the room? Anybody work with finances? Somebody keeps a budget for the church, right? So there's some weird accounting that goes on in these verses. Jesus says, in the very first verse, these things that don't make sense, he says that if they receive you, then they receive me. And if they receive me, then they receive the Father. So if they receive you, they're receiving me because I sent you, but my Father sent me. And so they're really receiving my Father is who they're receiving. And you're like, I don't know exactly how that tracks, Jesus. That sounds like the logic that some of my kids use when they're trying to explain to me why their brother or sister needs to be in trouble when they're the ones who did the wrong thing, right? Like, well, he and she did it and he said it, but then I didn't do it. And so you're lost on what it is that Jesus is actually saying here of how people receive awards. But notice that it makes sense when we talk about prophets, when we talk about righteous people, that you would receive a reward for receiving them. Of course, if there was a prophet that showed up today, all of us would be ready to welcome them into our house. If there was a righteous person who we all respected, we would gladly welcome them into our home. But note that Jesus also says there's a little bit of a leveling factor here, that not only is it the righteous person, not only is it the prophet, it's even the least of the people who follow me. That if you receive them, you receive the same reward as if you were receiving a prophet or a righteous person. He says that don't worry if there's no righteous person or prophet among you. Even if you're stuck with a Zane McGee, you can still receive the least of these, and you can still have a reward for serving and receiving people. Amen. I also want us to kind of think about another aspect of this verse. So not only do we have the odd accounting that goes on, but we also have what I would kind of call a divine currency transfer. Now, anybody who's traveled internationally knows that whenever you go from one country to another, especially if you go through airports, as you're leaving the airports, there's tons of little booths of people who will be trying to get you to exchange money, right? You're coming in with American dollars, and you land in Brazil where you need to get reais, which is the currency there, and you go up to there, you hand in your dollars to them, they give you back an equal amount in whatever the exchange rate is of your currency. One of the things that we always gave people as a tip when they came to Brazil, where my wife and I were missionaries, is we would tell trips that came, we would say, don't exchange a large sum of money into reais, right? Because everybody comes over and they want to, you know, I've got $1,000 US for this trip. I'm going to exchange it all for Brazilian reais and spend it. And we say, don't do it for two reasons. One, it's not safe to walk around with that large a quantity of money on you, cash. And two, you might not spend it all. And if you don't spend it all, what happens when you leave Brazil and go back to the United States? You either have to transfer it back over and lose more money in the process, or what most people do is you forget. And I can't tell you the number of times that we were home on furloughs from Brazil where somebody would come up to me after a trip at a church where they had come and visited us and we were there in the States. They would come up and extend their hand and they would say, you probably have more use for this than I do. And they would open their hand and they would have a 20 reais bill or a 40 reais bill. Why did they still have that money? It had been years since they had been on a trip to Brazil. But they still had this Brazilian currency because it was completely useless to them in the United States. And so what I want us to think about is this idea of a divine exchange, a divine currency exchange, of how we are taking things that have limited value, that only have physical value in this realm, and we are transferring them over into a divine currency, into a currency that has value and purpose, a superior value in the heavenly planes. In this passage, we see this because we have the prophets. We have the receiving of prophets and righteous people. And in receiving them, it's transferred from a physical act of kindness into a heavenly reward that is received. Now, I know that this sounds a little bit strange. It can sound like this is a little bit ethereal, that it's up in the clouds, and it's talking about divine things, and what purpose does this, what application does this have in our world today? But I think we actually see this in some examples of our own life. So I want to share with you a story that I think illustrates this, not from a religious perspective, not from a Christian perspective, just from a day-to-day situation that we can learn from. So in 2016, in Baylor Medical Center, in Dallas, Texas, Brenda Jones was a great-grandmother who was admitted to the hospital with deteriorating health conditions. She had been in a steady decline of health. Doctors had told her and her family that without some type of miraculous intervention, that likely her life would end fairly soon. She was in this hospital for quite a bit of time, had been struggling with her declining health for over a year. And at the same time that she was in the hospital, another woman, Abigail Flores, came into that very same hospital. Abigail Flores, like Brenda, had deteriorating health, but it was on a much more advanced timeline. Doctors told her that she was having catastrophic liver failure and that within a matter of days, she would die if she was not able to receive a liver transplant. Now, doctors set about the impossible task of getting onto an organ donor wait list that takes years for people to receive donations, did a national database search to find somebody that could be a compatible donor, and the first result that they got back was actually for Brenda Jones, the great-grandmother who was in that very same hospital at that very same time with declining health. In what one doctor later described as a highly unorthodox request, to say the least, Brenda's doctors met with her, explained to her the situation, and said, we would like to request, if the timing works out, that you would designate your liver to be used for Abigail. Brenda agreed to that request, and as things unfolded over the next several days, Brenda was able to receive a liver. And she received that liver, she recovered quickly, and she was able to return home to her family. Abigail, I don't think I mentioned, was 29 years old at the time, just recently married. Now, we can talk about the physical act of Brenda giving a liver and what it means to physically give an organ to another person. But what Brenda gave to Abigail was not an organ. What Brenda gave to Abigail was time. It was memories. It was one birthday. It was a one-year anniversary for her marriage. It was giving her time to create the future that she and her husband had dreamed about. So in a sense, we can think about the gift that Brenda gave as a way of exchanging something that was physical into something that would have eternal consequences as well. Abigail said this about how grateful she was for Brenda's actions. She said, "It makes me feel good because my husband and I, we had just got married and we want to have kids, and Brenda gave me the opportunity to be able to do that." So Brenda not only gave a future to Abigail, but gave a future to her and her children as well. When we transform the physical into the spiritual, we participate in making something that is worldly into something that is divine. Now, the easiest mission sermons are those sermons that ask you to get your checkbooks out, write a check to support missionaries, and then you can leave and brag about meeting your fundraising goal. The more challenging sermons are those that commission you to be the ones who are doing the mission work of the kingdom. To be the ones who, like Brenda, are giving of yourselves, creating, transforming physical opportunities into divine opportunities and divine results. Now, before we close, I want to say that it doesn't matter what you do. In Greece, in France, in Ghana, in Honduras, it doesn't matter how much money we give today to support those works, not today, but in the coming weeks. It doesn't matter how much prayer we offer to these mission works. If we ourselves are not engaged in the actual work of missions here in Oklahoma City, then we are neglecting the call that Jesus has given us to be missional. I want to draw our attention back to, we started in verse 40. I want us to take a step back into verses 39, 37 through 39. And look at what Jesus says. I told you the whole warning of things that Jesus has told the disciples to be ready for, even up to being ready to lose your body, but know that you're keeping your soul. And he says this in verse 37. "If you love your father or your mother more than you love me, you are not worthy of being mine. Or if you love your son or your daughter more than me, you are not worthy of being mine. If you refuse to take up your cross and follow me, you are not worthy of being mine. If you cling to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for me, you will find it." Let's read that last verse again. If you cling to your life, you will lose it. But if you give it up, you will find it. Now, this verse can make us really uncomfortable. Nobody likes Jesus telling you to hate your mother and father, right? Nobody likes Jesus telling us to take up our cross and follow him. But here's the simple truth of what Jesus is asking. Mothers and fathers and daughters, they represent the things that are most personal to us in our lives. And Jesus says, if you're not willing to give up those things that are most personal to you to serve other people in my name, then you are not worthy of being called mine. And he makes it more personal. Not only is he talking about the things that you hold personally close to you, but then he goes so far as to say, your very life, your very person, if you are not able to give those things up for me, then you're unworthy to be called mine. And I want to emphasize that sometimes we can make these verses about the question of being willing to do those things, not the questions of if we actually have to do those things. Jesus here isn't asking us to be willing to do those things. Jesus is asking us to do those things, to give up the things that are most closest to us and most personal to us in order to help other people benefit. I want to tell you a little bit more about Brenda and Abigail. I was a tricky preacher in that I didn't tell you the full story. There's a couple more details. So Abigail, when I said that Brenda gave Abigail her liver, I didn't mean that Brenda left her liver to Abigail after she died. What happened is that Brenda was in the hospital with declining health because Brenda, for over a year and a half, had liver failure herself. Brenda was on a wait list for over a year waiting to receive a donation of a liver. And on the very same day that doctors came into Brenda's room and told her, "Good news, after a year and a half of waiting on the list, you've been moved to the top and you will receive a liver transplant," they came into her later that day and said, "There's somebody here in this hospital who is dying in the next few days and needs that liver. Will you give it up for them?" And she didn't have to, but she chose to. And Brenda said about this that she didn't feel right taking something for herself that she knew would give so much opportunity to somebody else. So it's one thing for us to think about what it means for us to give and designate organs after we're dead and we no longer have a use for them. It's another thing for us to think about giving away an organ that is literally your opportunity to live in order that somebody else could have that. Brenda's gift, as I said, transcended the physical, and it gave Abigail life. The happy ending to this story is that Brenda, a few days later, also received a liver transplant. And there's actually a picture of you see on the screen of them recovering. They were across the hallway from each other, recovering from liver transplants at the same time. Brenda helped Abigail see and receive something that she couldn't have if Brenda had have been selfish and kept what was rightly hers. She had waited for a year and a half for that. She had been patient. I'm sure at other points she had been close to receiving a liver that had gone to others who had more demand than her. But her time had finally come. And in that time of opportunity, she was willing to give it up to serve and help others. I know that when we talk about missions and mission Sundays, it can be easy for us to get distracted by dollar signs. It can be easy for us to think about that the church is focusing on money or that all the church is really after is my money. The bottom line is, if we're being honest, the things that the church does needs physical resources, right? The church needs money to buy food for people. The church needs money to buy clothing and to travel to help people. Those things have to be paid for. But what the church is really interested in is not the money that you are giving. We are interested in the act of going and in the act of giving of ourselves and in the act of doing. Because in those things, we transform the funds that you give to support missions into eternal results that change the lives of people. We change bank accounts into life and joy and rejoicing for those who are lost. So I want us to think about that as we prepare over the next several weeks to support our mission works around the world, as we think about all of the countries where we're doing, where you all are doing incredible things. Think about how you can use those physical resources that you have and your own life here in Oklahoma City to be changing the lives of people around you. I want to close by calling us back to the example of Christ. If we had time, I would love for us to spend more time today talking about what it means to be self-sacrificial in the example and the pattern of Christ. But we know this, that Jesus Christ came, that he gave himself for us, and that he did it at a cost of his very own life so that we could benefit from us. And when we are called as Christians to participate in God's mission in the example of Jesus, we are called to that exact same standard, that we are called to be giving of our own lives and our own profits and our own benefits so that other people can benefit from those. I want to ask you to stand as we close with a song. If there's anything that the church can be praying for you with, if there's anything that we can